Hi, good evening. My name is Cheryl, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank Bill for asking me to come and speak tonight, share a little bit of my experience, strength, and hope. And I was always told early on that, you know, if and when I spoke, I needed to give you my sobriety date and tell a joke. I can give you my sobriety date, which is April 7, 1980, but I'm lousy at jokes. I can remember the punchline, but I can never remember the follow-up to it. Now, one interesting thing is I am married to Bob, the manager of Central Office, and that's not a joke. But I want to share something funny that happened this last weekend when we went over to San Luis Obispo. District 22 had their 44th convention, and we went over there. And Saturday morning, we got up early and went over to Avila Beach, and we took a couple of gals with us that hadn't been to the beach in a long time. And we're over there enjoying the scenery at the beach, and the water's cold. It's about 9 o'clock in the morning, and there's a lot of people, you know, getting ready to go out on kayaks and people with their dogs. And here comes a beach guy down the beach. And, you know, we do appreciate God's creations. And this guy was really nice-looking guy. All he had on was a pair of beach shorts. And you could tell he was a surfer-type guy, or else he worked out a lot. We were really appreciating his what God had created. And he was tan. Oh, my goodness, this guy had a tan. And it wasn't a brush-on tan either. And so we're kind of oogling at this guy, and we're talking to him, me and the girls. Bob's kind of standing back. And Bob's got a little bit of a hearing problem. And Bob walked up to me, and he whispered, "What's this guy got that I haven't got?" Well, what I said to Bob was, "A tan." Bob thought I said, "A chance." So we kind of laughed about that for a while, but that was pretty good. We have fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're not a glum lot most of the time. We're supposed to be happy, joyous, and free. My sobriety date is April 7, 1980, and I really appreciate Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really appreciate my sobriety. And when I got sober, if anybody had said that I would have celebrated 29 years of sobriety, I would not have thought that possible, because it just seemed like so far away, something that I couldn't even comprehend. I was the youngest of three girls, and I was born in the mid-40s, and I had two older sisters that were teenagers, and when Mom got pregnant, she didn't tell my sisters she was pregnant until she started showing, and my sisters were pretty embarrassed. They were teenagers, and moms and dads weren't supposed to do that kind of thing back then, and the girls, number one, were resentful. Number two, we're very jealous. Number three, thought this new baby was going to ace them out, I guess. But they were less than kind. And the one thing I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is this thing that we call love. You know, we love one another unconditionally. We love one another to help in sobriety, to help people sober up. We learn that we have a loving higher power. And it was kind of confusing, the love that I learned about growing up. I would get kissed, and I would get held, and I would get rocked, and I would be told that, you know, "Cheryl, I love you, sissy," and stuff like that. And I'd be thrown in the river when I was three, pulled out by my sister's boyfriend before I drowned. I'd be dunked up and down in the toilet, you know, held up by my heels. The girls really didn't like me. And yet, you know, it was hugged and told how much I'm loved, and yet, you know, put out in a herd of horses that were less than tame, and so my concept of love was kind of, there's a price to pay for being loved, and it's not a really nice price. You know, there was attempted strangulations and chokings and stuff like that. But thank goodness I learned to talk at an early age, so the folks kind of figured out what was going on and called my grandmother in to babysit. The folks figured out the girls couldn't be trusted. And I didn't really, I was scared of my sisters, actually had a lot of fear, and I brought in a lot of fear. I don't blame the girls, and I don't blame my childhood for being an alcoholic. I believe I was born an alcoholic. You know, before I took my first drink, I liked food. You know, that gave me comfort. And I didn't know when to quit. And then when I took my first drink at 17, it was vodka. And I didn't know when to quit. My girlfriend and I bought a fifth. We split. I didn't know you were supposed to, you know, dilute it with orange juice or whatever. And I drank half and she drank half. She puked and felt okay, and I was sick for days and swore up and down I would never touch vodka again. And that was my first lie about drinking. You know, I when I was drinking that vodka, there was this warm, magical feeling, and I had always been a real shy, what I thought was a real shy child, a real shy person. I couldn't think of things to say. I'd want to talk. So many of my friends were talkers, and I would just freeze up, you know, I couldn't even think to say, hello, how are you? My first sponsor in AA, I told her, I said, I can't talk. I freeze up. I get a knot in my throat, and I just, you know. And I said, I want to talk to people, and I want to know what's going on. And she said, just walk up to somebody and say, hey, how's it going? So that's what I've learned how to do, is walk up to people and say, hey, how's it going? And, of course, I've gotten over a lot of that fear of talking, and now, you know, you can't really shut me up a lot of times when I get talking. Shyness is not one of my problems anymore. I had a lot of fear and a lot of terror about not drinking. It was about 8 years. I bounced in and out of AA for about 8 years before I quit drinking. And I had a lot of fear and a lot of terror. What was I going to do and how was I going to live by not drinking? I went to AA meetings and I thought it was just wonderful what you people were doing, straightening up your lives. But you see, I'm not an alcoholic, and I can drink. And that was a lie I was telling myself. I told myself a lot of lies, and I tried and tried to believe those lies. But there were the blackouts. There were the geographics. I got fired from a job because I was drinking and somehow wound up on a plane to somewhere in Bloomsburg, Oregon, and you know, couldn't get back because it was a snowstorm, called my boss crying with an excuse, and it really was a good excuse. I mean, I didn't know how I got there. And he had the audacity to fire me, expected me to be to work on time, of all things. And I just thought, boy, he's really unsympathetic. And I, you know, I continued to drink. My concept of love was if I had a man in my life, that was what would validate me. That was what would make me real. So I talked some poor guy into getting married when I was about 19 years old, and he was going off to Southeast Asia, and we got married, and my dad was mad because this guy's mom was an alcoholic, and my dad was a sheriff's deputy with Tulare County, and daddy dealt with a lot of drunks. You know, I didn't care. I wanted to get married because I had this fantasy in my head. I wanted the little house with a picket fence and the kids and the, you know, the real or imagined stuff in my head. That's what would fix me, you know. That would make the hole in my gut go away. And I knew the marriage was over day after me and this guy got married. And I had it all in my head, you know, how it would go. We spent the night at his brother and sister-in-law's house. And next morning I'm up and I'm fixing bacon and eggs and toast. And this is the way you're supposed to do, the leave it to beaver and cleaver and all that happy horseshit. He comes out of the bedroom and he shrivels up his nose and he said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm cooking breakfast. You know, and I'm all happy and I've got this fantasy going on in my head about the way it's going to be. And he says, I hate eggs. I don't eat bacon. I don't eat toast. You know, I want a Pepsi. I want a bag of peanuts. And I'm thinking, this can't be happening. So that was our first date. That marriage didn't last very long. You know, I had two boys out of that marriage. But, you know, my my thing was, well, you know, throw this one away and go find another one. That's what I did. And so I had a lot of baggage with fellas when I came into AA. Actually, the first meeting I went to up in Springville, and I was serious about getting sober this time, and I walked in, and it was John the Barber, who was Bob's sponsor. And John the Barber came up to me in that AA meeting, and I think I had maybe 3 weeks of sobriety, and John came right up to me and stuck his finger in my nose, and he said, "Cheryl, if you're looking for a man, there's the door." And he said, "But if you're looking for sobriety, you can sit down here and shut up and listen." And I was insulted, highly insulted. And I wanted to leave, but I didn't want to look bad. So I stayed. And then they say, you know, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, and I had come out of my fourth marriage. Actually, me and the old boy were still messing around when I got sober, or admitted I was an alcoholic, and I was willing to get sober and do anything it took. And I didn't wait a whole long time between relationships, you know. I mean, I had to take care of myself. And what I found out, one of my, the book talks about the nature of my defects of character. And I found out the nature of my defect of character is Cheryl's going to protect Cheryl no matter the cost, no matter what it takes. You know, Cheryl's going to take care of that fear. Cheryl's going to take care of the terror. I got to, you know, just take care of number one. Selfish self-centeredness, I believe our book talks about. So, you know, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then whatever it takes, well, there's Bob. In a meeting, and he's single. And, you know, I'm a couple of months sober, and Bob was almost 5 years sober, and I asked him, I didn't have a car. Hell, I blew up my Volkswagen because it was supposed to take oil, and I was too busy going places to put oil in it. So I asked Bob for a ride to AA meetings, and he was nice enough to do it. He had a job. He had credit. He had money in the bank. He had a checking account. These were things that, and he had a car. These were things that I didn't have. The bank had refused me checking account, to open a checking account. My credit stunk. I was on welfare. I had 3 kids by that time. Had been shooting angles, lying, cheating, stealing. And, you know, and I needed a way out of this. So Bob and I dated, and when I was 8 months sober and he was 5 years sober, we got married. We got married on December 26, 1980. Bob says he got in the spirit of giving and gave himself away. And it was kind of a price to pay for that one. We split up a week later. Last December, Bob and I celebrated 28 years of marriage. The first 10, 15 years were really rough when you have two self-centered alcoholics. The first part of our marriage was like a drunk-a-lot. You know, we would have, both of us have had raging tempers, alcoholic tempers, you know, throwing things, cussing, screaming, slamming doors, kicking feet through doors, you know, tearing up a house. We've been there, done that. And it took some outside counseling, you know, for us to work through some of that stuff, and also going to meetings and working with sponsors and doing what we had to do. Bob's somewhat of a miracle. Today I call him Woodstock. He's wearing a peace sign necklace around his neck. I have a lot of names for Bob. Today I call him Woodstock. And he also plays golf. And when he plays golf, I call him Bobcat Forrest because he's not Tiger Woods. And I've got a couple other names for Bob, but, you know, I try not to use those. I have to admit that I'm human and I get mad and I say things. So my first sponsor told me that a foul mouth was a sign of no growth. And I didn't want to look bad. I wanted to look like I've grown a little bit, so I try not to throw the F-bombs around. But boy, I'll tell you, somehow it just seems like when I get mad and lose my temper, I don't know where that stuff comes from. It really does. I have to admit, I've got an ego that sometimes really tries to get the best of me. And I understand ego means edging God out. Cheryl wants to run the show. Cheryl wants to control. You don't understand. I know the way it should be. And that's really simply not so. You know, I'm grateful to be sober today. I am so grateful to be sober today. I have not pointed a loaded gun at somebody since I've been sober, and I have not taken shots at people since I've been sober. And, you know, and I'm grateful because I know under the influence of alcohol, I was pretty crazy and I really didn't care. I never thought about the outcome, you know. It was always, I've got to take care of me and this is what I'm going to do right now. And I was a pretty destructive drunk. When I got mad, I didn't care, you know, if I tore my hands up. The husband I had before I got sober, he liked the ladies. I was working two or three jobs, and he liked to go out with the gals, and he was telling me that they were just friends, and, you know, he'd take them to dinner, and he'd take them to the bars, and he'd take them here, and he'd take them there. And one night I got off work, and I went looking for him, and I found him in the bar with a gal, and I got mad, and I used my fists and tore his pickup truck up. And it was a pretty cherry-looking little truck, too. But I, you know, busted out the headlights, busted out the windshield, ripped out all the wires in it, tore the leather seat covers out. I think there was a country western song not too long ago about something like that. And I identified with that because, you know, that's what I did. I got pissed off, and then you were going to pay a price for it. And, you know, I've had to learn since I got sober, I blamed people, places, and things. That's another part of the big book I can identify with. I was in the blame. It was their fault. I wouldn't have behaved like that if they hadn't have done me wrong. And, you know, they rip my heart out and stomp on it, you're going to pay a price for it. You know, do me wrong, say something bad about me, there's going to be a price to pay. What I learned since I got sober and doing a lot of fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh steps and quite a few eighth and ninth steps, men's, I was the problem. I was there. I caused it to happen. I can't blame anybody. I've got to look at my part. And I'll tell you, with my ego, looking at my part is so dadgum hard sometimes. Geez, the insanity returns, you know, and I haven't drank, but boy, I can recognize that insanity. And it's just I love my higher power today. I choose my higher power. I call my higher power God. And when I got sober, my sponsor told me about step one, which by then I admitted I was an alcoholic, which I hadn't done for 8 years. So I knew I'm an alcoholic. I can't take a drink successfully. When I drink, I do crazy things. It didn't matter what I drank, where I drank it, how much I drank it. The minute that booze hit my mouth and went into my body, my brain went bling, my body went bling, and I was off and having a wonderful time, so I thought. But the wonderful time only lasted about 8 seconds. And then I was doing things and just being totally insane. You know, and I'm not like that. I was afraid when I got sober, number one, that I was such a mean person that I was not a nice person. And I've learned that I am a nice person, and I have a nice, quiet spirit. And I have a good giving heart. And it's taken me getting sober and looking at that. It's taking me to realize that alcohol is my enemy. It's not my friend. And it romanced me for a long, long time. You know, and I've had to learn that I've had a lot of fear that I've had to work through and look at. I've had a lot of anger that I've had to deal with. Just this last 8 months, I've done several fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh steps. And looking at my part, I don't deal with change really well. And that's one thing, when I got sober and they said, you know, you don't have to do anything but change. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I can't stand this. I was afraid of change. And then they would say, you know, you don't have, there's a saying, you don't have to fear anything, something about, oh well, I can't remember it. But, you know, I was just a very fearful person and afraid of my own shadow, you know, afraid of going places, paranoia. I had a lot of paranoia when I got sober. You know, they were out there, they were going to get me. But I've learned since that that's not so. I believed that God didn't like me. That's where my spiritual thing was when I got sober. And my sponsor was talking about the second and third step. Coming to believe and then, you know, turning my will and my life, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I can't. The God that I had in my head was very judgmental. He was going to get even. I was going to burn in hell. How could I do anything and have God love me for what I did? I just had a lot of judgment on myself. And what I've come to learn, and this is my thing. I don't expect anybody else to swallow this or to believe it, but I read a book last winter that a friend of mine gave me, and it talked about spirituality and how God loves us and treats us, and it said, you know, that if I'm the kind of a person that believes in Judgment Day when I die, that for me there's not going to be any judgment other than God patting me on the shoulder and saying, Cheryl, why were you so hard on yourself, my child? I am so sorry you were that hard on yourself. And that just really did it to me, you know, because I have been really hard on myself a lot of times. And I'm an overachiever. I'm trying to find that balance. You know, it's either all or nothing. I'm going to go into it 180%, or I'm going to say, screw it. I can't do it. I'm a failure. I've tried. I can't do it. And one thing I've had to learn is I'm not a failure as long as I keep trying. After I got sober, I had this brilliant idea. I was 3 months sober. I had a sponsor. And the only reason I got a sponsor was because I was afraid somebody was going to ask me if I had one, and I didn't want to look bad and say no. So to look good, I got a sponsor. And she was one of these people that worked the steps. So I had this brilliant idea. You know, how can you get these brilliant ideas with broken thinkers? For God's sake, I just don't understand that. But I still get brilliant ideas. And I was going to go to college. You know, I graduated from high school with a 1.9 grade point average. Damn near fail. I mean, you know, hated school. I was going to drop out of school when I was a junior. And my dad said, if you quit school, you are out of here. You go pay your own rent, get your own job, buy your own groceries, buy your own clothes. And I started thinking about it, and I thought, you know, maybe staying home's a better deal at this point. So I barely squeaked through high school. So, you know, there I am, 35, and I decide I need to go to school, need to go to college. And I was 3 months sober, and this group of AA people were listening to me. And one thing, when I got sober, I shot my mouth off all the time. If I had a thought, you guys heard it, and you were always telling me about it, politely correcting me. And I was told, Cheryl, you're too emotionally disturbed. You're unstable. You can't go to school. You got to wait till you're 5 years sober. I'm thinking, what? How can they talk to me like that? Don't they know who I am? And this one lady said, honey, she said, you won't cut it. She said, I'm going to tell you, you got to be sober 5 years before you even have a chance. And I was just heartbroken. But, you know, I believed her, and I stayed sober for 5 years, and 2 months after my fifth sobriety year, I took a test, because I thought I wanted to be a teacher. So I took this test, and I studied my butt off for that thing. I studied for 4 weeks, 6 hours a day for this test, because I wasn't a test taker, and I knew I was stupid, and I knew I was a failure. And I took this test, and then I got a letter a couple of weeks later in the mail, and I was scared to death to open that letter. I called Bob at work, and I said, my God, I got the results of the test, and I don't know what to do. I was shaking just like a leaf, and Bob said, open the letter, Cheryl. So I opened it, and I passed this test, and I said, whoopee, God means that I'm to go to school. So I enrolled in Porterville College, and I had a lot of wreckage of the past to clean up out there, and I had to go to school 3 years just to clear up the wreckage before I could start on my career to be a teacher. And it took me 11 years, and I worked full-time as a teacher's aide, and I graduated, and I went on to graduate school, and I teach today. I'm a special ed teacher, and I always say I teach what I am because learning was very hard for me. I don't process well. Reading, they'd say, read the book. You know, I'm saying, oh, God, read the book. I can't understand what that book says. and I would have to really read slowly and really try to do it. But I managed to get through college, and the last 2 years I was on the dean's list, for God's sake. I couldn't believe that. I get these letters in the mail, and I say, Bob, they don't know who they sent this to. They've made a mistake. And it was just incredible, you know. And I do have to get a I get a resentment at people that have maybe got 3 months sobriety and they enroll in college, and then they come into an AA meeting and say, I got all A's, I'm on the D's list. And I'm thinking, oh, crap, I don't want to hear that. You know, but it takes what it takes. And so I love my job. I really do. I love my job. I love those. I teach at high school level, severely handicapped, and I have a lot of fun with those kids. And it's really challenging. It's, you know, the field of education is getting tough, but one day at a time, and I just put one foot in front of the other. I had to take a look at, I had to do an inventory on my, the way my sisters treated me. I had a resentment, and I didn't realize it was a resentment until one day, one of my sayings, I had a lot of sayings, was don't let the left hand know what the right hand is doing. And in doing that, it meant that I was being dishonest with myself. And I had a love-hate relationship with my sisters. And after my dad died, my sisters threatened me. I was 4 years, almost 5 years sober when my dad died, and he left me in charge of his estate, which was basically nothing. But the girls thought he had millions. And they got really ugly with me, and I, you know, it was the AA people in the fellowship that pulled me through that, because boy, it hurt to have my sisters really, you know, I got death threats in the mail from those girls, and I had a good attorney that was in the fellowship also, and he said, well, your dad's put down here that if anybody fights this thing, they only get a buck. He said, we'll remind your girls, your sisters of that. So they left me alone, and you know, the sad part is, I think they got about $20,000 a piece, and one of them, she owed it all to the IRS. I mean, she never even smelled the money, you know, they took it. And the other one bought a motorhome that blew up on her, and I mean, that was all there was, you know. And, so, a couple of years later, I had to do an inventory on those girls, and I came to realize that, you know, they did the best they could when they were teenagers. They absolutely, my dad did the best he could. He wasn't a loving, kind man. Dad, you know, he was a lawman. He was a cowboy. He was not huggy, mushy. You know, you do your job and buck up, pull yourself up by the bootstraps and move on, you know. You don't feel sorry for yourself. You don't ask for a handout. You take care of yourself. And I realized that Dad did the best he knew how, and my sisters did the best they knew how. You know, it was survival for them and for me. And I've chosen not to have a close relationship with the girls. The oldest one died of a heart attack when she was 58, and I know it was her mean spirit that killed her. I mean, that girl could hang on to a resentment for years. And plus she drank, you know, about a fifth of gin a day. So I know that, you know, it was this disease of her hatred that killed her. My other sister, I'm not going to call her an alcoholic, but I'm going to say that she drinks very heavily. She's a daily drinker. And every time we talk to each other on the telephone, which is about twice a year, I call her on her birthday and then I call her at Christmas. And she's drunk, you know, and she slurs, and that's okay. You know, that's the way it is. And I have a family in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that's my family, and that's okay. I was raised with a lot of old ideas, and I've had to look at those old ideas. I've got a piece of advice for you before I go on. Don't ever ask God to reveal your old ideas. Let me tell you, I made that mistake. Boy, several months back, I says, well, I'm doing so good, I don't think I have any old ideas left, do I, God? And boom, I mean, it's been hitting me like F hits the fan. One of my old ideas was I place expectations on how people should treat me. And I've had to look at that a lot lately, you know. I need to accept people as they are. And the big book talks about this all the time. You know, I accept people as they are. Don't put expectations on how people should treat me. You know, and I've learned another thing, that I can trust everybody. The 12 and 12 tells us that we can't get hurt feelings unless we set ourselves up to have hurt feelings. And I know that today. I can trust everybody. And I say that without any reservation. Now, I'm going to clarify that remark. I can trust people. I can trust some people that if I tell them something in confidence, I can trust that they're going to go tell it to somebody else. I can trust that there are sober horse thieves. I can trust that there are wonderful people, you know, that are sincere and kind and loving. And I can trust that there are some people that simply can't be trusted. But, and I'll tell you, I've learned that recently, that I trust everybody. I'm just coming to learn how they can be trusted. My old ideas, I've had some old ideas about, and this is kind of personal, but, you know, I've been married 5 times, and this marriage is 29 years, and it's been kind of different. I had some old ideas about what marriage was, too, and I'm learning about that. You know, my husband's an alcoholic, and he's going to be speaking here next week, and his story is a lot different than mine. And he's been changing. 14 years ago, he had a massive heart attack, and the doctor told me to call the mortuary that he wasn't going to come out of it. And, boy, I was praying my butt off on that one, and they're shooting him full of morphine, and he's screaming at them that they can't be giving him morphine because he's an alcoholic. And I finally just went in there and said, shut up, Bob. Let them do what they have to do. And so he finally quieted down. Well, you can see he survived that. And his behavior changed a lot because of it. He used to be a type A, go get him, you know. Oh, well, anyway, I won't take his inventory too much. And he also survived bladder cancer. He got bladder cancer 3 years ago and had to go through chemo for that. And skin cancer, you know, he's had some stuff going on in that area. They thought his bladder cancer returned a couple of months ago. And when they went in there and checked things out, what they found was he's got crystals in his bladder because he doesn't drink enough water. And I am a bitch about drinking water. I'll drink your water. And he goes over to central office and he makes a pot of coffee. And he's still got a little bit of rebellion. He's going to show me he's going to drink that coffee. So, you know, my old ideas about marriage is something that I'm working on today. And when I get it all figured out, I'll let you know. But, you know, a lot of these old ideas came from being raised as a child, and it came from experiences that I experienced in life, and it came from reading books. And what I'm finding out is some of it doesn't always work. It's like I had a tremendous broken thinker when I got sober, and I sometimes still take all those thoughts and try to work with them in sobriety, and it doesn't work. And I, the one thing I do rely on is my higher power to get me on the right path. And I'm still going through stuff, you know, but it's okay. I know there's hope. And so, you know, if you're sitting there thinking, you know, if you don't have 29 years of sobriety yet, and you think, well, gee, if I get 15, 20, 25, 30 years of sobriety, life's going to be hip, slick, and cool, and I'm just going to be sailing into the sunset. That may happen for some people. It hadn't happened for me. And, you know, Sunday, Bob's always been kind of a fraidy cat. I'm going to tell you a little bit of his story. Just take a little bit of an inventory to let you know what kind of a fraidy cat he was when I married him. I always picked guys that needed to be needed. They needed somebody to take care of them. You know, they needed a caregiver, and that was me. When I married Bob, he'd been out of a 17-year marriage, and his wife was an addict and an alcoholic, and they'd been apart about a year. And Bob was a real shy guy, And they used to have K-Jug radio, and they used to have the K-Jug girl in her short shorts and her little slinky top and all this stuff. And she'd take this little car wherever it was and give out free gifts and stuff like that. And Bob told me that his dream was to go find the K-Jug girl and shake hands with her. So we load in the car, and she's over in Lindsay with the little teardrop radio thing they've got. And I'm driving over there, and Bob's got sweat pouring off his forehead, and his hands are real clammy, and his shirt's real wet, and he says, "Cheryl, I can't do this. Turn around, go back." I look at her and say, "What are you talking about?" He says, "I'm so nervous I can't do..." He says, "My God," he says, "my voice is even shaking." He says, "Don't stop the car. Don't stop the car. I can't do this. I can't do this." And I'm thinking, "Oh, my God. This is ridiculous." And I said, "All you have to do is get out of the car and shake her hand." And by then, he was such a basket case, I didn't stop. And when he got his ear pierced, that was about the same. Bob used to have long hair, ponytail, and a pierced ear. And same thing when I took him into the jewelry store to get his ear pierced. My God, he was crumbling before the guy got there with the ear piercing gun. Now, Bob is changing. He's changing. This just blows me away. And I haven't written it. I haven't talked to my sponsor about it yet, but I'm going to. I have a sponsor with 30 years of sobriety. Bob's been talking about doing an event that he used to say he would never do, no matter what. People were stupid that did it. No idiot would do that. And this was what I had gotten used to. Well, Sunday, this coming Sunday, Bob's going to drive over to Lompoc with a couple of friends, and he's going to go up in an airplane, and he's going to jump out with a parachute. Now, I'm not going. And I told him, "I'm not going. I love you. I'm not going." And he says, "Why?" And I says, "I won't tell you why till you come back, if you come back." So he's a real good example of what Alcoholics Anonymous does, and he'll be sober 35 years in December. You know, I think it was read here just a little bit ago, you know, and I was, the context was, and I was told this, there are no limits on what we can do or achieve in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There are no limits. The limits are between my ears. Thank you. Keep coming back.